Glenn Beck. The Blaze Radio Network.
Abortion has been such a hot-button issue for so many that it's become a topic to be avoided. The discussions are so contentious and minds so set that in many circles it was thought to be foolhardy to even broach the subject. But ever since the undercover Planned Parenthood videos shined another spotlight on the subject,
and we are able to obtain intact fetal cadavers,
the barriers have now been torn down.
Said, you know all about this.
You know, you can imagine where they would run with this. Like, they're selling body parts, you know.
So I say, okay, what are you looking to supply today?
In 2015, the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, recited a common refrain of the pro-abortion activists.
We do not support rolling back the protection that the constitutional right to make your own reproductive choices established in Roe versus Wade has given to women.
It should be noted that the United States Constitution actually says nothing about abortion specifically. And while it is true that the Supreme Court ruled in favor of legalized abortion in 1973, the U.S. Supreme Court cannot write constitutional amendments, meaning women's reproductive rights are still not mentioned in the Constitution. The Constitution's preamble does promise to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, end quote. It would seem that the unborn babies would qualify as our posterity, and thus are deserving at a chance for life and liberty. However, since there is no language in the Constitution specific to abortion, was there anything our founding fathers said or wrote to indicate their feelings on the subject? For that insight, author and historian David Barton.
After America separated from Great Britain and the Founding Fathers made their own brand new and unique government, they still preserved and protected the legal position against abortion. This fact was made clear by Founding Father James Wilson. James Wilson was one of only six founders who signed both the Declaration and the Constitution. He was the second most active member at the Constitutional Convention, and he was placed as an original justice on the U.S. Supreme Court by President George Washington. Wilson began America's first organized legal training, and he authored our first legal textbook for students in which he told law students, quote, "With consistency, beautiful and undeviating, human life, from its commencement to its close, is protected by the common law. In the contemplations of law, life begins when the infant is first able to stir in the womb. By the law, that life is protected," end quote. American law was clear. As soon as it was known that there was life in the womb, at that point, that life was protected by law, for the purpose of government was to protect all inalienable rights, including that of life. In the Founders' Day, they recognized that there was a right to life in the womb as soon, as James Wilson said, quote, "the infant is first able to stir, that is, when movement could be felt inside, and thus they knew for sure that there was indeed life within." But with today's technology, it is now possible to know with a certainty that life is within the womb from only a few days after conception. Regardless, whenever it is known that life was within, according to the documents penned by our founding fathers, at that point, unborn life was to be protected under the law.
In the late 1700s, America's attitude on life stood out compared to the rest of the world. Because our founders believed the things that they did about God and nature, there was a difference between the law here and elsewhere around the world.
According to our founding documents, a primary reason that government exists is to protect the inalienable right to life, which included unborn life. Interestingly, during the time of the founders, America's position on protecting the life of a child was quite different from what was practiced in many other nations even at that time. Across much of secular Europe, it was wrongly believed that parents and not God gave life to their children. So under the law in those countries, parents had the right to take their child's life. After all, they believed they had given it. But Americans knew that the life of a child came not from parents, but rather from God. Parents therefore had no right to deprive an unborn child of its life. As signer of the Declaration, John Witherspoon acknowledged, quote, "Some nations have given parents the power of life and death over their children, but here in America, we have denied the power of life and death to parents," end quote. Because God himself gave to every individual the inalienable right to life, America's early state laws were very clear on the prohibition against taking an unborn life, such as the law in Virginia during the time of Founding Fathers Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, which declared, quote, "But if a woman be with child, and any gives her a potion to destroy the child within her, this is murder, for it was not given her to cure her of a disease, but unlawfully to destroy the child within her," end quote.
It is also true that America's feelings on abortion predate the U.S. Constitution, as Barton explains.
From our earliest beginnings, abortion was always seen as wrong. For example, for the first century and a half following our initial colonization, America was under British law, and the policy on abortion throughout that time was explained by British judge and legal writer William Blackstone, who was a particular favorite of our founding fathers. In fact, Thomas Jefferson quipped that American attorneys studied Blackstone with the same devotion that Muslims studied the Quran. Concerning abortion, Blackstone said, quote, "Life is the immediate gift of God, a right inherent by nature in every individual, and life begins, in contemplations of law, as soon as an infant is able to stir in the mother's womb. For if a woman is quick or alive with child, and by a potion or otherwise kills it in her womb, or if anyone beat her, whereby the child dies in her body, and she's delivered of a dead child, this was by the ancient law homicide or manslaughter," end quote.
No one today, with the possible exception of one of Donald Trump's many points of view on the subject, would favor a woman being charged with anything should an abortion occur. Instead, as during the pre-Roe versus Wade years, the abortion provider would be charged. The discussion has become so twisted, though, that now the baby and the father, for most abortion activists, don't even factor in the equation at all. As NARAL spokesman Elise Hoag put it,
"Very, very complicated decisions, which is why when Americans hear how complicated those situations are, that they are among the most complicated medically, they believe that the choice should remain between a woman and her doctor."
Most people would never suggest that, for instance, the choice of whether or not to fix a car should be between a woman and her mechanic, leaving her husband out of the decision entirely. But abortion proponents have no problem insisting that even when a human life and a father's child is at stake, the choice is only for the woman and her doctor. But the spin by abortion supporters continues, as with this initial paragraph from a Center for American Progress article in 2013. Quote, "If recent legislation passed in Arkansas and North Dakota is allowed to stand, it will be harder for women to get an abortion in those states than it was in New England in 1650. End quote. Doubtful, since again, the colonies operated under British common law, which made abortion illegal. Quote, "Legislators in Little Rock and Bismarck have passed new restrictions that ban abortions according to when a fetal heartbeat is detected, which can occur as early as 6 weeks into the pregnancy," end quote. You might think that a heartbeat would be a fairly good indicator of life, but apparently not, at least for the Center of American Progress. Quote, "Federal judges have blocked the new restrictions until legal challenges to their constitutionality are settled. But the six-week deadline contrasts starkly with early American abortion laws, where the procedure was legal until the quickening, the first time the mother felt the baby's kick, which can happen anywhere from 14 weeks to 26 weeks into pregnancy," end quote. First, the procedure was not legal until the quickening. It was an illegal misdemeanor. And the reason it became a felony after the quickening is that there were obviously no ultrasounds at the time to detect life prior to the movement by the baby, or the quickening. So it was the only way to tell for sure that there was life in the woman's womb. It may well be that America's founding fathers didn't specifically address the abortion issue because they couldn't conceive of a people that would destroy the lives of 55 million unborn babies in a 43-year period of time. In the next episode, we explore the world created by Planned Parenthood founder Margaret Sanger and the eugenics movement.
Glenn Beck.
This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Glenn Beck. The Blaze Radio Network.
The year 1957. Mike Wallace interviews the then 78-year-old Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood, a group that receives nearly $500 million a year in taxpayer money to function as America's largest abortion provider. Near the beginning of the interview, Wallace sought to determine her motives for her stance on birth control.
Just this past year, on May 21st, the New York Times summarized an important study of the world's food resources made by Professor James Bonner of the California Institute of Technology. Professor Bonner says the world is not using 1 billion acres of potential agricultural land, and he adds that if this land were used and present agricultural land were improved, the entire world could be fed adequately, even if the population increased by one-third in the next 50 years.
Oh, Mr. Wallace, you hear so many fantastic things of what can happen, what may happen. This and that, I've heard it for the last 30 years anyway, of what could be done, but it's never done. And the demographers, I never heard of anyone that would agree with that, that we could have another in the world.
Another third.
Mrs. Sanger and all the demographers, of course, turned out to be right. The world didn't handle a population increase of another third. Instead, it handled an increase of 2.5 times what the population was in 1957, going from just under 3 billion people to more than 7 billion today. And yet there are fewer starving people in the world, percentage-wise, than at any time in human history. Even a young Mike Wallace seems shocked by some of what he heard from Margaret Sanger that day.
Do you believe in sin? When I say believe, I don't mean to believe in committing sin. Do you believe there is such a thing as sin?
Well, I think the greatest sin in the world is bringing children into the world that have disease from their parents, that have no chance in the world to be a human being, practically. Delinquents, prisoners, all sorts of things just mark when they're born.
Unfortunately, Wallace didn't follow up with Sanger on her crystal ball vision for unborn human beings, which apparently informed her, with some degree of certainty, which infants would have no chance in the world to be a human being, practically, end quote, which would become delinquents and prisoners, nor what kind of mark they had to identify them at birth. But she would explain this comment a little further at another time. More on that later. Sanger, who claimed to be an Episcopalian during the interview, was asked by Wallace to clarify whether, other than giving birth, was anything else a sin.
Do you believe that infidelity is a sin?
Well, I'm not going to specify what I think is sin. I've stated what I think is the worst sin.
Yes, but then you asked me to say what, and I said what, and you refused to answer me?
Yes, I don't know about infidelity. It has so many personalities to it, and what person's own belief is. I couldn't generalize on any of those things as being sin.
Murder is a sin.
Well, I naturally think murder is a, whether it's a sin or not, it's a terrible act.
Sadly and strangely, Wallace never asked Margaret Sanger about the most controversial aspects of her character, her association with eugenics, and the fact that she was an obvious racist, of which there is ample evidence.
The eugenic and civilization value of birth control is becoming apparent to the enlightened and the intelligent. The campaign for birth control is not merely of eugenic value, but is practically identical in ideal with the final aim of eugenics. Margaret Sanger, 1921.
In her autobiography, Margaret Sanger wrote about a speech she gave in 1926 at a Ku Klux Klan rally in Silver Lake, New Jersey. The Planned Parenthood founder bragged about the fact that afterward, she was invited by 12 other Klan chapters to speak at their events.
Because of Margaret Sanger's vision, there are, in fact, disproportionately fewer blacks in America than any other race.
Since 1973, legal abortion has killed more African Americans than AIDS, cancer, diabetes, heart disease, and violent crime combined. Every week, more blacks die in American abortion clinics than were killed in the entire Vietnam War. And the largest chain of abortion clinics in the United States is operated by Planned Parenthood.
This is African American pastor Clenard Childress.
We have now reached a point in this country that African American women, though they make up 12% of the population, they account for 37% of the abortions. An African American baby is almost five times more likely to be aborted than a white child. The abortion industry at this point kills as many African American people every 4 days as the Klan killed in 150 years. And you can truly say the most dangerous place for an African American to be is in the womb of their African American mother.
In Sanger's 1922 book, Women, Morality, and Birth Control, she wrote,
"We should hire three or four colored ministers, preferably with social service backgrounds and with engaging personalities. The most successful educational approach to the Negro is through a religious appeal. We don't want the word to go out that we want to exterminate the Negro population, and the minister is the man who can straighten out that idea if it ever occurs to any of their more rebellious members."
From her public paper, America Needs a Code for Babies, in 1934, Sanger wrote,
"Give dysgenic groups in our population their choice of segregation or sterilization."
And in her magazine, Birth Control Review, she said,
"Birth control must lead ultimately to a cleaner race."
If it sounds familiar, it should. It's essentially the same policy advocated and carried out by Germany's Nazi leader Adolf Hitler, whose sterilization policy Sanger openly praised. Most people associate eugenics with Hitler and the Nazis, and while the Nazis may have perfected the movement, they did not start it. It began in England and spread to the United States very early in the 20th century.
Of course, when we say the 20th century, we ask ourselves, who is running the 20th century? The 20th century was being run by guys from the Civil War, just as our 21st century is being run by guys in the post-Vietnam era. And these guys from the post-Civil War period brought all of their racist baggage into the 20th century with them. They considered themselves reformers. They considered themselves liberals, progressives, and utopians. And their idea of a utopia was a world in which no one would exist who did not resemble themselves. And they believed that poverty was a genetic trait, criminality, chastity, morality. So, in other words, you weren't born into poverty. Poverty was born into you. And the best way to get rid of poverty and improve the world was to get rid of the people who had this genetic trait.
As chilling as it is to realize that there were actually Americans who felt this way, it's even more chilling when you come to the understanding that those who championed those opinions and theories founded Planned Parenthood and are revered by today's American progressives. Progressives like Hillary Clinton, who in 2009 said,
"To have an opportunity to participate in the Planned Parenthood annual meeting, I have to tell you that it was a great privilege when I was told that I would receive this award. I admire Margaret Sanger enormously, her courage, her tenacity, her vision. Another of my great friends, Alan Chesler, is here, who wrote a magnificent biography of Margaret Sanger called Woman of Valor. And when I think about what she did all those years ago in Brooklyn, taking on archetypes, taking on attitudes and accusations flowing from all directions, I am really in awe of her. And there are a lot of lessons that we can learn from her life and from the cause she launched and fought for and sacrificed so greatly."
Adolf Hitler faced some of those same accusations. In both instances, the accusations were true. Margaret Sanger was, in fact, a racist and eugenicist who advocated for the, quote, extermination of the Negro population, end quote. Clinton was asked at a congressional hearing about her strange, open, and obvious admiration for Margaret Sanger.
Your remarks last month when you called Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood, a person whom you enormously admire, were stunning to me. Margaret Sanger clearly embraced bigotry and racism. She advocated for the elimination of the disabled, the downtrodden, and the black child. In one of her writings, she said, "Today, eugenics is suggested by the most diverse minds as the most adequate and thorough avenue to the solution of racial, political, and social problems."
Well, Congressman, let me say with respect to your comments about Margaret Sanger, you know, I admire Thomas Jefferson. I admire his words and his leadership, and I deplore his unrepentant slaveholding. I admire Margaret Sanger being a pioneer in trying to empower women to have some control over their bodies. And I deplore statements that you have referenced. That is the way we often are when we look at flawed human beings. There are things that we admire and things we deplore.
It would be impossible to imagine a conservative politician surviving similar comments about David Duke and how they admire his work fighting for the elimination of the IRS, and that he vehemently opposed communism. But they deplored his time as Grand Wizard of the KKK while comparing him to George Washington, who owned slaves. But in this peculiar place Americans currently find themselves, this is business as usual. Planned Parenthood founder Margaret Sanger and her supporters receive a pass for her downright evil and strongly held beliefs, apparently because of her organization. In addition to also helping take the lives of 55 million unborn children, they also offer advice on where women can go to get a mammogram. Next time, Roe versus Wade and its aftermath.
Glenn Beck, The Blaze Radio Network.
The Supreme Court today ruled that abortion is completely a private matter to be decided by mother and doctor in the first 3 months of pregnancy. The 7-2 ruling to that effect will probably result in a drastic overhaul of state laws on abortion. Specifically, the court today overturned laws in Texas and Georgia and ruled the government has no right to enter into a decision which should be made by the mother and her doctor. During the second 3 months of pregnancy, it ruled, a state may regulate abortion procedures, but only to ensure the safety of the mother. And in the last 3 months, whatever state laws say prevails. Laws in 17 states may be affected by that ruling.
Indeed, the ruling did just that. It also sentenced 55 million unborn babies over the next 42 years to death, including well over 14 million African-American children. And it overturned centuries of laws prohibiting taking the lives of the unborn. So how is it accomplished? How could a nation that promised the blessing of life and liberty to its posterity, a nation that so treasured its children, become capable of allowing so much of its posterity to be wiped out before birth? Lies and spin. First, the spin. Pro-abortion activists became something everyone could love. Pro-choice. Who could possibly be against choice in America? Once that was accomplished, it wasn't about aborting an unborn baby anymore. It was about a woman's right to choose what she wanted to do with her body. In order to nullify the objection over the human being growing inside the woman's body and whether that human being should actually factor into the equation, they also began a campaign to dehumanize the human fetus by referring to it as tissue or cells. Marxist socialist Noam Chomsky discussed the value of life as it relates to a human fetus.
There are conflicting values, and taken in isolation, each of the values is quite legitimate. So the value of preserving human life, or for that matter, the life of any organism, that is a value that we should accept. You shouldn't just go arbitrarily kill some animal because it's fun to kill it. That's a reasonable value. On the other hand, most people will agree to swat a mosquito. Okay, well, that the idea that life is should be valued has come into conflict with another value.
As incredible as it seems, the spin from celebrated leftist Chomsky seems to compare swatting a mosquito with aborting and killing an unborn baby. But his bizarre analogies didn't stop there.
Everyone in the debate is opposed to outright infanticide, that is, taking a live child and deciding to kill them because it's too much trouble to take care of them. Everyone agrees on that. Everyone agrees, I suppose, that women are allowed to wash their hands. Although, I guess you could make a case if you went over to the biology department that when a woman washes her hands, lots of cells flake off, and some future technology might be able to use the information in those cells to construct a potential child. So somewhere between, say, washing your hands and killing your three-year-old, somewhere between that, there are decisions to be made about how we're going to balance what we call life, which in fact is there in the cells on your hand, how we're going to balance what we call life against lots of other problems.
If you can get a decent percentage of Americans to believe that taking the life of an unborn human baby is akin to swatting a mosquito or washing your hands, you have won the war. Princeton professor Peter Singer, someone who doesn't have a problem identifying the fetus as human life, but also has an even more shocking attitude about abortion.
Ultimately, of course, the whole decision is based on questions about what you think makes killing wrong. And I think that's one reason why the philosophical discussion with the general public has not got very far, because people haven't really confronted that issue. They've tried to say, well, the fetus is a human being or the fetus is not a human being, just accepting the premise that killing innocent human beings is always wrong. I think if they'd gone a little bit further and said, well, in one sense, the fetus obviously is a human being. It's a member of the species Homo sapien, and it's alive. But what are the characteristics that make it particularly wrong to kill a human being? Why do we think that killing a human being is normally wrong? And I think if you start asking those questions, you get to see that it's not just being a member of the species Homo sapiens that makes killing wrong. It's rather the fact that, us, you and me, and anyone else listening here, is a being that has got certain capacities, can think, can want to go on living, is aware of the fact that he or she is living and wants to go on living. And all of those things contribute to why we think that for someone, say, just randomly to shoot people in the street is a terrible thing. But none of that applies to the fetus. The fetus is, well, when most abortions are performed, the fetus is not even conscious, and it's certainly never a being who can think, I want to go on living.
If the spin wasn't enough, there were also lies. Prior to the Supreme Court ruling that overturned abortion bans in 1973, much was made about the safety of women who were apparently seeking illegal abortions in so-called back-alley abortions. One of the most prominent among the activists speaking out for women's safety was renowned abortionist and co-founder of NARAL, which at the time stood for National Association for the Repeal of Abortion Laws, Bernard Nathanson. Nathanson was a man who had overseen some 75,000 abortions at his clinic, performing over 5,000 of them himself. In fact, one of the abortions he personally performed took the life of his own child when he gave his girlfriend an abortion. Nathanson co-founded NARAL to remove the stigma of abortion and to remove all laws that limited it. To do that, he and his group spread the lie that abortion was not a moral issue, but a purely medical one. In addition, Nathanson and his allies lied relentlessly and spectacularly about the number of women who had died each year from legal abortions. They claimed to American voters, lawmakers, and judges that women were going to seek abortion in roughly equal numbers, whether it was lawful or not. The only effect of outlawing it, they claimed, would be to limit pregnant women to unqualified and often uncaring practitioners. Back-alley butchers, they said. As a result, Nathanson and the others insisted that America's laws against abortion were worse than futile. They were actually costing women their lives. Nathanson claimed that between 5 and 10,000 women died each year from illegal abortions. The actual number in 1972, the year before Roe v. Wade, was 39. Antibiotics had greatly reduced the number of deaths from abortion, which averaged around 250. Still nowhere near the figure given by NARAL in the 25 years prior to 1973. How do we know that Dr. Nathanson lied about his numbers? Well, he himself said so. Here's the quote.
It was always 5,000 to 10,000 deaths a year. I confess, I knew the figures were totally false. I suppose the others did too, if they stopped to think about it. But in the morality of our revolution, it was a useful figure, widely accepted. Why go out of our way to correct it with honest statistics? The overriding concern was to get the laws against abortion eliminated, and anything within reason that had to be done was permissible.
Bernard Nathanson started having a change of heart as soon as 1 year after the nation's abortion laws were overturned. By 1980, he had given up the abortion industry entirely and eventually became active in the pro-life movement and later converted from atheism to Christianity. But the damage had already been done. The lies had worked. In 1970, a young woman who lived in Texas became pregnant with her third child. She had already given up her first baby to her mother, her second to her father, and now here she was again. She wanted an abortion, but they were illegal in Texas. So Jane Roe, as she would come to be called in court, found two young lawyers who wanted to challenge the laws. They initially lost their court battles, but appealed all the way to the United States Supreme Court. And in 1973, their case was heard and won, when the Supreme Court ruled 7-2 in Roe's favor, negating the abortion laws in 46 states. Jane Roe, who, by the way, never had the abortion. Instead, she gave the baby up for adoption. Discussed how her lawyers handled the situation.
They started pounding, you know, all this. Well, don't you think women should have the right to control their own body? Yeah! They never said anything about, it's really a baby, Norma. You're going to be killing your baby. Don't you know that you're signing an affidavit to execute the next three generations of children to come? They didn't say anything like that. I didn't have a clue. I was ignorant. I mean, I was dumb.
Roe, whose real name is Norma McCorvey, she also came to deeply regret her decision and her part in overturning abortion laws. For decades since, she has been a committed warrior in the pro-life movement. It's a bittersweet irony that two of the people most responsible for the legal abortions now in this country, NARAL co-founder Bernard Nathanson and Roe of the Roe v. Wade court case, Norma McCorvey, became adamantly and actively pro-life. In the next episode, the abortion battle as it exists today.
Glenn Beck.
In the 43 years since abortion became legal throughout the country, 55 million babies have been destroyed. As an earlier episode discussed, hundreds of years of laws and the basic belief that a fetus is a human child were erased from much of society very quickly. The battle, and thus the effort to change what we know about biology, continues as the pro-life movement seeks to stop the slaughter. Pro-abortion activists so control the debate today in America that in 2015, Planned Parenthood was exposed. In addition to providing the vast majority of abortions in this country, it was discovered through secret video recordings that they also sell body parts from aborted babies. Even so, their federal funding remains uninterrupted to this day. As shocking and gruesome as that is, too many Americans remain unalarmed. So much so that abortion supporters are using people like Bill Nye, the science guy, as a spokesman for the forefront of the abortion apologist movement.
Nobody likes abortion, okay?
No, Bill, it's not okay. Even if you're a fan of Bill Nye, who once had a rapidly edited children's TV show, and a man who is not a scientist, by the way, you have to wonder how he could ever make a statement like that with a straight face. There are many, many people who love abortion and vehemently fight for it daily. And those who send hundreds of millions of taxpayer dollars to fund abortion mills, like Planned Parenthood, every single year.
But you can't tell somebody what to do.
For pro-life believers, that's like saying you can't tell someone that they can't kill another human being, because you can't tell them what to do. When it comes to taking a life, of course, you can, and you must, if you're to be a civilized society. If this weren't such a deadly serious issue, it would be almost comical listening to people like DNC chairperson Debbie Wasserman Schultz avoid referring to her own children as human before they were born.
You have three children, correct?
I do.
What are their ages?
I have twin 16-year-olds and a 12-year-old.
And in your opinion, were they human beings before they were born?
You know, I believe that every woman has the right to make their own reproductive choices.
What did you believe about your children, though?
That I had the right to make my own reproductive choices, which I was glad to have, a right which I was proud to have.
So were they human beings, or yes, just yes or no?
They're human beings today, and I'm glad that I had an opportunity to make my own reproductive choices as a right that every woman has and should maintain.
Well, Congressman Schultz, they weren't occasional chairs in the womb, and then suddenly babies after birth. The left seems to enjoy referring to the right as science deniers over things like climate change. Yet they continually deny the fact that what grows inside of a woman's womb is a human being. But listen now to President Obama, then Illinois State Senator Obama. Listen to him as he asks for clarification when discussing a bill about whether a child born alive during a failed abortion should then receive medical treatment. A bill, by the way, that Barack Obama opposed.
As I understand it, this puts the burden on the attending physician, who has determined, since they were performing this procedure, that in fact this is a non-viable fetus, fetus or child, however way you want to describe it, is now outside the mother's womb, and the doctor continues to think that it's non-viable, but there's, let's say, movement or some indication that, in fact, they're not just coming out limp and dead, that, in fact, they would then have to call a second physician to monitor and check off and make sure that this is not a live child that could be saved.
It is almost painful to hear him contort and twist in his opposition to a bill that would save a live birth baby's life and essentially refer to a baby that has been born as a fetus outside the womb. The woman, whom many consider to be the odds-on favorite to become the next president of the United States, spoke to the Women in the World Summit in 2015.
Laws have to be backed up with resources and political will, and deep-seated cultural codes, religious beliefs, and structural biases have to be changed. As I have said, and as I believe, the advancement of the full participation of women and girls in every aspect of their societies is the great unfinished business of the 21st century. And not just for women, but for everyone. And not just in faraway countries, but right here in the United States.
In order to bring about that kind of abortion-on-demand world she envisions, Hillary Clinton actually said deep-seated cultural codes and religious beliefs have to be changed.
When or if does an unborn child have constitutional rights?
Well, under our laws currently, that is not something that exists. The unborn person doesn't have constitutional rights.
The United States extends rights to illegal aliens, terrorists tried on our soil, and mass murderers. How is it possible that an unborn person, as she admitted the fetus was and is, doesn't have constitutional rights? The answer, of course, is it isn't possible. Rights are granted to the unborn, or our posterity, from the very beginning of the Constitution in the preamble. But today, there is so much diversity in the Democratic Party that the other Democratic candidate for president in the 2016 race felt exactly the same way Hillary and virtually every other Democrat did.
I do understand and I do believe that it is improper for the United States government or state government to tell every woman in this country the very painful and difficult choice that she has to make on that issue. And I honestly don't want to be too provocative here, but very often conservatives say, you know, get the government out of my life. I don't want the government telling me what to do. But on this very sensitive issue, of which this nation is divided, right. A lot of people agree with you, a lot of people agree with me. But my view is, I respect absolutely a family that says, no, we are not going to have an abortion. I understand that, I respect that. But I would hope that other people respect the very painful and difficult choice that many women feel they have to make and don't want the government telling them what they have to do.
Conservatives want the government involved where it should be involved, protecting life. It's interesting that a socialist, who in fact does want the government involved in virtually every aspect of your life, all of a sudden doesn't want the state or federal governments involved in one of the few things that it actually should and in fact must be involved in. Then Republican presidential candidate Ted Cruz summed it up this way.
I think the first obligation of everyone in public office is to protect life. Life is foundational. In fact, as you look at the Declaration, that ordering of unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, I think is a very deliberate ordering. Without life, there is no liberty, and without liberty, there is no pursuit of happiness, that each builds upon the other.
The left speaks of the Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision as if it had been carved into tablets on a mountaintop. They once spoke also of the 1883 Supreme Court decision allowing individuals and corporations to discriminate against blacks the same way. It is time for Americans to realize that Supreme Court decisions are not the final and only word in this land.
Glenn Beck.
This is the Glenn Beck Program.